I hope you can understand my lack of enthusiasm for that, the Lieutenant Major told her. Your people better be worth the Void's cursed hassle, Riley. Augments are no augments. They're no better than mine in battle armor. Until this war started, they might have been, Riley replied. We had a lot more action during the peace than your Marines did. But you're right. My people's best use is when we're out of armor. Right now, Lieutenant, I'm frankly concerned about their reliability as much as their effectiveness. How much of a problem are they going to be? Less than they have been, she said flatly. Inserting a Black Ops platoon into a Marine company was never going to be easy, so I was expecting friction and didn't step on it. Now, though. It stops, Lieutenant Riley, Edvard told her. I'm not going to presume innocence on the part of Marines, but we cannot have any more of this kind of bullshit. I can't afford to cut the company's strength by a dozen troopers, but by the stars, I will throw every idiot who gets into a fight in the brig regardless. You're in command, sir, she agreed. My idiots will follow my orders, and I'll follow yours. My non-coms and I will crack down on the attitude problem. Regardless of their barracks issues, though, my men will fight and will follow the plan in action, she concluded. They're some of the best we have. Some of my Marines have been with me since the Ansem Gulf incident, Edvard pointed out. I've walked into 6 different kinds of hell with them. There's no one on this ship that isn't among the best we have. You may want to remind your people of that. Chapter 13. New Edmonton System. 1000, May 26th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon. Kyle sat in the command chair at the center of Chameleon's bridge, watching the streams of data running through his implant with a practiced mental eye. He was surprised by how much he missed the physical backup screens that allowed old-fashioned situational awareness to kick in, but the neural feeds were almost as effective. Seconds ticked away as the Q-ship's icon approached the marker in his data feed where she would exit Alcubierre Drive, and Kyle did his best to look as relaxed and cheerful as always. Glass was still playing his cards close to his chest, and Chameleon's captain wasn't certain what he'd meet in the New Edmonton system. It was possible his people would be going into battle, and the last time he'd commanded a battle, a lot of people had died. Even in his own head, he couldn't argue much with the general assessment of his peers and superiors that he hadn't actively screwed up at Hui Xing, but he still felt there had to be something he could have done better. Alcubierre emergence 90 seconds, Lau reported. On target.
Taylor, Rokos, ready? Kyle asked.
Active sensors are locked down to avoid drawing attention, his tactical officer reported. Lance source cells spun up. Our one missile salvo is prepped and in the launchers. Deflectors are ready to come up at civilian radiation protection level. Chameleon is ready for whatever you need, sir.
Birds are locked and loaded, Rokos reported once Taylor was done. 5 squadrons of glorified showboats ready to go on your order.
Thank you, Kyle replied. Taylor, who are we today anyway? He asked with a chuckle.
We're the Centauri Registry Freighter Golden Moonlight, sir, she replied swiftly.
There was no point in flying a Q-ship if they were going to arrive in every system flashing their Federation ID codes, after all.
Emergence 10 seconds.
Kyle waited. Exiting the warp bubble created by the Alcubierre Stetson Drive was always sudden. One moment, all of reality around you was torn to incoherent shreds by the gravity wells that created your bubble of spacetime. The next, reality snapped back into place with a suddenness the human mind couldn't quite comprehend. In the center of the screen was an immense gas giant, one of the largest Kyle had ever seen. A super Jovian, on the edge of becoming a brown dwarf. McMurray, source of hydrogen and rare gases for half of the Stellar League.
What am I looking at? Kyle asked, watching as Taylor's team started dropping icons onto his screen.
That's a lot of extraction infrastructure, the tactical officer noted slowly. I'm reading at least 1,500 cloud scoops, 24 central processing stations, thousands of prospecting ships. I've never seen anything like it.
That was almost 5 times the processing infrastructure around Gawain, which represented the largest hydrogen extraction facility in the Federation and one of the biggest in the Alliance.
"I'm not reading any defenses," she said quietly.
"They're there, Commander,"
Glass said softly, the spy stepping onto the bridge with a confident stride.
"The League makes a hobby of war in a way that makes no sense to most of us. While their internal wars are fought by specific rules, they don't expect anyone else to fight by them. The McMurray production stations are guarded by mercenary pilots who've seen more battles than anyone else outside of a war," he continued. "Their gear isn't quite as good as ours, but it's better than the Terrans' current starfighters."
Both the Commonwealth and the League were flying 6th-generation starfighters versus the 7th-generation spacecraft the Alliance now had deployed across their entire fleet. The cataphract-type League starfighters Rokos's people were flying were late 5th-generation birds, replaced in most League service by the hoplite type. Inferior to the Falcons or not, in the hands of the League's mercenary condottieri pilots and crews, the hoplite was a dangerous, dangerous starfighter.
"Where are we headed, Mr. Glass?"
Kyle asked the spy, managing to not sound utterly frustrated with the man.
"Chameleon wants to head to high orbit near the Nexon cloud in the 3rd ring, Glass told him. "The cloud sticks out to scanners, so it's a common waiting ground for ships negotiating refueling status. I'd suggest you do so from there, but I will be taking a shuttle into one of the processing stations to meet with my black market contact."
"I will accompany you," Kyle decided. He'd been kept in the dark on the nature of this mission for too long.
"That would be unwise," the spy said slowly. "Shouldn't you remain with your ship?"
"I need to be fully informed on our missions, Mr. Glass," Kyle replied. "Commander Chownik is perfectly capable of negotiating our resupply."
Glass looked like he was going to argue for a long moment, then sighed and shook his head.
"I'm not going to win this," he acknowledged aloud. "I presume you have something other than a uniform to wear?"
Given Chameleon's covert status, Kyle actually had multiple civilian outfits aboard. With modern computer technology for image substitution, there was no need for him to be out of uniform under normal circumstances, and the full-body ship suit that resembled a turtleneck and slacks at a distance was a relatively standard garment galaxy-wide. He'd switched out in this case for a slightly differently cut ship suit in dark blue instead of military black, and strapped a shoulder holster under a black leather jacket. Glass looked him over as they met in the shuttle bay and nodded approval. The spy wore the same plain civilian suit he'd always worn, though Kyle knew from the ship's safety systems that he wore a thin ship suit under the black suit. Lieutenant Riley and the 2 Black Ops troopers that were joining them were in a mix of ship suit styles and jackets closer to Kyle's array than Glass's. All 3 carried slung, stubby carbines, not a model Chameleon's captain was familiar with.
"They're okay with us hauling that kind of hardware?" he asked, indicating the guns with a jerk of his head.
"Not in most places," Riley said with a grin.
"But the new Edmonton processing stations have a reputation. No one is going unarmed here."
"Station 7 is not, despite what Riley implies, a lawless hellhole," Glass pointed out. "It is, however, notably lacking in what even the League would regard as sensible gun laws. Riley's guns will be fine. We have no enemies here," he continued. "But there are people here who will try and rob us without personal rancor. Outside of my contact, no one here knows that we are Federation. Keep it that way."
"We're off the freighter Golden Moonlight,"
Kyle reminded them as he stepped into the shuttle, his implants linking into the small spacecraft's computers and artificial intelligences.
"Looking for cargo while my XO negotiates fuel and food?"
"Exactly,"
Glass confirmed with a small smile.
"We may make a useful spy out of you yet, Captain Roberts."
Kyle settled into the control chair and flashed the older man a grin.
"If you're going to insult me like that, I suggest everyone strap in," he ordered.
Local space around McMurray was crowded by space standards, and there was no planetary system-wide traffic control. All Kyle could do was keep a careful eye on the vectors of everything around him and make sure that his own course kept him well clear of those vectors. The shuttle's AIs handled most of the straight number crunching involved in that, however, and he had more than enough attention to spare to take in the view. McMurray was a gorgeous world, even by the breathtaking standards of super Jovian gas giants, with whorls of blue and green cutting across a mostly red base. It lacked moons, but had 7 rings of varying consistency, the Nexon cloud representing a portion of the 5th ring that was densely filled with rocks and debris, making it harder to detect anything in its shadow. The rings added to both the navigation hazard and the light show, sunlight from New Edmonton glittering off the ice and metal that made them up. The processing stations that orbited the planet in carefully measured circles sat just inside the innermost ring. In a way, they and their cloud scoops formed an 8th man-made ring around the planet. Each processing station consumed the gas from over 100 cloud scoops and hundreds of prospecting ships diving through the outer atmosphere. The stations were fragile-looking things, especially compared to the more military structures that Kyle was familiar with. Massive fuel storage tanks that looked like, and functionally were, glorified balloons hung from kilometer-long struts, with dozens of pipes dragging the unmixed gases and fluids away to the refining plants that turned it into saleable product. A single spherical Alcubierre-capable tanker nestled against one end of the station, and 2 cylindrical sublight ships were linked in along the way. As they grew closer, Kyle's passive sensors finally picked up the defenders. 12 hoplite-type fighters maintained lazily varying orbits above the platform, watching for any kind of threat. The system quietly pinged him to inform him that Processing Station 6's space traffic control was requesting a data handshake. No one was verbally reaching out to him, but the data systems were talking to him. He authorized the handshake and linked in to the STC. A new course flashed up on his systems, and he dropped the shuttle into it, arcing the spacecraft toward the designated docking bay. None of the hoplites paid any attention to him, their condottieri pilots clearly having dismissed the unarmed ship as a non-threat, a piece of overconfidence that could have easily destroyed the station. Small or not, the shuttle was capable of over 400 gravities and contained a zero-point cell producing a small but constant stream of pure antimatter when active. That antimatter fueled its engines, fed into a secondary power generation system, and filled capacitors to make sure those systems continued working. Rammed into one of the gas balloons, or the core of the station, the shuttle would turn Processing Station 6 into a massive and expensive fireball. Of course, Kyle had no intention of doing any such thing, but the lack of concern was disconcerting. 10:35, May 26th, 2736 ESMDT, McMurray Processing Station 6. As Kyle settled the shuttle down on the floor of the docking bay, Glass gestured for Riley and her troopers to join them.
"We are meeting a man named Kamil Ostrovsky," he told them. "Despite being in the League, he was born on Old Earth, in Poland, of all places."
Kyle was relatively sure he wasn't the only one drawing a blank on where that was.
"He's very high up in one of the organized crime families that are woven throughout the Commonwealth and the League," the spy continued. "I'm relatively sure his Bratva family have fingers into Alliance space as well, but Pakhan Ostrovsky works in the League and has fingers all the way back to his homeworld."
"If he knows who we are we sure he's okay with selling out Terra?" Kyle asked.
"Ostrovsky was caught by Commonwealth Internal Security 23 standard years ago and sentenced to a very long time in prison," Glass said with a wicked smile. "He escaped, but his biometrics are on too many lists. Even with his resources, he can't go into Commonwealth space for very long. He hates the Commonwealth and is perfectly happy to sell them out for money. Speaking of which, Riley..."
The Black Ops lieutenant hefted a briefcase.
"I'm guessing this is for him?"
"That's a good chunk of the price of a starship in bearer bonds. Be a bit more careful with it, please,"
Glass said plaintively. Riley looked thoughtful.
"I'm not sure about that," she pointed out. "Were I actually the mercenary thug I'm dressed like, You would not have told me that.
Fine, Glass allowed. Roberts, you're the ship captain, but don't use your first name. While no one is likely to recognize you by face, even here they've probably heard of the Stellar Fox.
The interior of the station was almost reassuring to Kyle. From the lackadaisical attitude of the security fighters and the frail-looking exterior, he'd wondered if the inside would show a similar failure of concern or structure. Instead, the hallways and corridors Glass led them through could have been on any modern space station anywhere in the Federation or its allies. Panels along the walls provided a diffuse but bright light. Doors had implant-authorized locks. Restaurants and stores hawked their wares. Security was rarer, but noticeably more heavily armed where they were present, than it would have been on a Federation station. But otherwise, the crowd with its mind-boggling variety of people and clothes could have been right back in orbit of Castle. Glass led them through the station with the confidence of someone who had either been there before or had a very up-to-date map in their implant. Dodging crowds and missing main commercial concourses for side corridors, he finally led them to a door that looked no different from any other they'd passed, and paused.
"Watch your manners," he said crisply. "Show Pakhan Ostrovsky respect."
The old man then rapped twice on the door, waited a moment, and then rapped three times. An old but simple identification trick, though one that Kyle presumed was followed by some kind of implant interrogation. The door slid open, and the spy led the way into a lushly decorated lobby. Thick carpet cushioned their shoes, and gorgeously detailed massive couches laid out a square around a holographic fire in the middle of the room. Bookshelves covered every wall, though Kyle presumed at least some had to do double duty as concealed doors. Two men in heavy combat vests, about as damage-resistant as unpowered armor got, stepped up to flank the Federation party, massive shotguns drifting gently to cover everyone.
"Weapons, now,"
the man on the right said in thickly accented English.
"Hand them over,"
Kyle ordered before Glass could speak, removing his own sidearm and offering it to the bodyguard. He hadn't really dealt with criminals in his life, but he doubted that insisting on hanging on to their guns counted as respect. The one guard collected their weapons, gracelessly surrendered by the Black Ops team, while the other ran a scanner over them. He looked unenthused.
"Watching," the speaker grunted at Riley. "Implants won't save you."
"Please, Ivan," a new speaker said calmly. "Our guests did not fly the length and breadth of Terran space to start a fight. Come in, come in."
The Federation party obeyed, Kyle surreptitiously studying the man in the couch on the other side of the holographic fire. Pakhan Kamil Ostrovsky was a large man, only a little smaller than Kyle himself, his graying hair cropped short to his scalp. He looked to have been massively muscular once, but now carried an immense gut. Somehow, Kyle doubted that the extra weight would stop the crime boss moving as fast as he needed to if threatened. For now, Ostrovsky was smiling as he gestured them to seats.
"It's Glass this time, right?"
he asked Glass genially.
"I always forget with you spies."
"You remember correctly,"
the old spy replied calmly.
"And I doubt you ever forget unintentionally."
Ostrovsky laughed and gestured to the couches again.
"Please sit, you're stretching my neck," he told them.
Kyle gingerly took a seat, suspecting that the couch cost about as much as the shuttle they'd arrived on.
"We had a deal, Ostrovsky,"
Glass reminded him.
"I have the money. Do you have what I asked for?"
"I do,"
the crime lord replied.
"But so fast to business. We should drink, have some scones. Maria!"
A young blonde woman materialized through one of the bookshelves, one Kyle now realized was an extremely high-fidelity hologram, carrying a tray of small cakes and shot glasses of clear liquid.
"Drink, eat,"
Ostrovsky commanded, grabbing a scone and a shot himself.
"It is all safe. What kind of man would poison his guests?"
Glass sighed and obeyed, and Kyle followed suit.
"I found what you wanted,"
the crime boss finally noted.
"There's a depot in the Aurelius system, used to support patrols along the border with the League.
They'll have munitions, fuel, food, everything you can need. I even, kind soul that I am, have their patrol schedule for the next 2 months, so you can strike when they are undefended.
Thank you, the spy replied, gesturing for Riley to pass over the briefcase.
The crime boss gestured for the girl to check it. Despite appearing to be the server, Maria had the case opened and the bonds flipped through in a second.
Exactly as agreed, she said calmly,
then disappeared back through the bookshelf with the case.
I believe that concludes our arrangement, Glass said. The data?
Ostrovsky removed a small disk from his pocket and tossed it to Riley.
If you have more of that money, he said lazily, I may have found something else of interest to you. Two things, in fact.
Each worth what you paid for the depot, he finished, his voice suddenly sharp.
I don't have that kind of discretion, Pakhan, Glass said respectfully. I could perhaps offer as much again, but no more.
We both know that's a lie, Mr. Glass. 1¾.
1⅓. And only because you've always come through before.
Ostrovsky smiled. It was a very predatory expression, one that made Kyle very glad he had 3 Black Ops cyborgs in the room with them.
1½, then, he suggested. Roughly. Call it an even trillion of your stellars.
Kyle couldn't conceal a wince. That was a chunk of the cost of a starship, and a not insignificant fraction of a percent of a star system's GDP. Just how much money was changing hands in this quiet little meeting? And for that matter, how much did Glass have available to spend? This time, instead of a briefcase full of bearer bonds, Glass removed a single data disk from inside his suit jacket. He tapped a finger on it, linking the disk to his implant and loading something into it, then passed it over to Ostrovsky.
There are 7 account numbers and access authorizations on there, the spy said calmly. All told, they add up to 100 billion Commonwealth dollars, 1 trillion Federation stellars.
I will trust you, Mr. Glass, the crime boss told him, taking the disk. You know the consequences of lying to me. Your first piece of information, and Maria will provide me a file of details in a moment, is that the Commonwealth has finally begun forward deployment of a 7th-generation starfighter, the Katana type. I'm not certain on what the specifications mean, but we have them. You should not encounter them at Aurelius, as Walking Stick has claimed the entire first production run for the Rimward Marches.
Kyle managed not to swear aloud. They'd known their one-on-one fighter superiority couldn't last forever, so they'd been leveraging it as hard as they could. If that intel didn't make it back in time, more than a few Alliance ops could run into an unexpected buzzsaw.
Secondly, the Commonwealth has been developing an entirely new type of starfighter, Ostrovsky continued. Several, from what I can tell. An 8th generation of starfighter, but also something entirely new. I don't know what they are thinking, but I do know that the specifications, plans, test results, and prototypes are all scheduled for delivery to the Terran Commonwealth Research and Development Center at Tau Ceti on June 10th. All of the information my network has on both of these items is on this disk, he finished, gesturing to where Maria had emerged once again, this time holding a single small disk identical to the one Ostrovsky had given them himself.
It is always a pleasure to do business with a professional, he noted to Glass. And I must confess that, quiet as he has been, it has also been a pleasure to meet Captain Roberts. It is rare that one sits in the presence of a living legend.
Kyle sighed.
I am no legend, sir, he said quietly. Just one man.
One man,
Ostrovsky agreed, chuckling.
One man that Walking Stick was prepared to trade his entire 23rd fleet to kill. You've made an impression on the good marshal, Captain.
The crime boss smiled.
I'm a fan of anyone who can piss off the Commonwealth Navy that badly.
Chapter 14. New Edmonton System. 1400, May 26th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon. Russell Rocco stood patiently behind the shoulders of the staff in Chameleon's primary flight control. Unlike the Q-ship's bridge, the flight control center was in the hidden portion of the ship and built to a proper military standard. It was also a Terran military standard, which had required some getting used to. A Federation warship would have used more in terms of individual screens backing up implant feeds, leaving each of the sensor techs working their stations with a unique view and requiring the supervisor to mirror people's feeds to their implant to follow an individual tech's work. The Commonwealth standard used large screens and shared holograms to make sure that everyone knew what everyone else was doing. There were arguments in terms of teamwork, Russell knew, but a number of small things about the layout and design told him that the designers had been more concerned about officers knowing what their subordinates were up to at a glance than intra-team efficiency. Right now, it was mostly allowing the wing commander to track every spacecraft near Chameleon with relative ease. Even out in the rings near the Nexon Cloud, an unusually marked concentration of hydrocarbon gases used as a waypoint, there were a surprising number of them. A dozen prospecting spaceships, barely larger than the 4,000-ton starfighters of his wing, disappeared and reappeared as they dove through the cloud itself, hunting the same precious radioactive materials that made them hard to see. Another starship also hovered near the cloud. It made a convenient anchor point for negotiating with the locals for fuel and other supplies. The locals knew that as well, which was why 250-meter, 300,000-ton gunships orbited just above the cloud. They seemed to be there as much to play tender to the dozen older cataphract fighters orbiting with them. The local mercenary guards seemed content to keep an eye on things from above, however, and Russell's link to Chownik on the bridge hadn't warned him of any contact from them. He had Lee and his Bravo squadron in their birds, ready to deploy if they were required, but Roberts's orders were to keep the fact that they had starfighters under wraps here, which is why he was not expecting the notification that one of the launch tubes was cycling. Chameleon was built around 10 ship squadrons and had the tubes and transfer systems to launch one such squadron every 15 seconds. With just one Federation 8-ship squadron in the tubes, two were empty, and one of those tubes was now charging to launch.
Launcher 9 is initiating an unauthorized launch cycle, a tech announced across the mental network linking everyone in the room together,
far faster than any of them could speak.
Override, Russell ordered. Do not let it launch.
The system is refusing my override, the operator replied,
panic edging over his mental voice.
I'm completely locked out on Launcher 9.
Russell cursed aloud as he linked into the system and hit the fighter launch tube with his own high-priority override, a code that should instantly cut power to the tube as an emergency measure. The launcher happily continued cycling before sliding open its covering hatch and firing the starfighter it contained into space in a blast of gravitational force.
Who the hell is in that bird?
The wing commander demanded.
Starfighter is refusing IFF ping, one of his subordinates replied. Checking who's still aboard,
the man swallowed.
It's Echo Actual, sir. All other starfighters are aboard and properly responding.
Chownik chose that moment to link in to Russell's implant.
Kag, what's going on?
He demanded.
I thought we were supposed to be hiding our starfighters.
So did I, Russell replied grimly. Are the condottieri responding at all?
No,
Chownik said.
It's your bird, Kag. What do we do?
Stand by.
He turned to his own people.
Get me a channel to that bird. I don't care if she's replying, just make sure she can hear me.
Despite the surprise and confusion, his staff were still moving competently and without chaos. He had his channel in under a second, a tight beam radio trained directly on the starfighter.
Flight Commander Cavendish, you are in violation of our standing orders and your launch is unauthorized. Return to ship immediately. That is an order, Commander.
He waited.
Is she responding?
He demanded after a moment.
No, sir. She's received the message, though I can't guarantee she's listening to us,
the tech replied.
XO, how long until she's out of lance range? Russell asked Chownik grimly.
4 minutes, the cyborg replied instantly. If she starts evading, our hit probabilities start dropping off in about 2 minutes.
Void, Russell spat. XO, clear one of the secondary lances and paint her with the targeting systems.
Done,
Chownik said grimly, turning his attention away to snap orders to the bridge crew.
Channel still ready?
Russell asked to a nod from his staff.
Commander Cavendish, you are now in violation of a direct order in a potential combat zone, he said flatly. If you do not turn back in the next 30 seconds, we will shoot you down.
Silence for several seconds, and then she finally responded.
Are you fucking nuts, Rokos? Cavendish snapped. I'm operating under orders. Get the stick out of your ass and get out of my way.
The only person authorized to give you orders is me, he replied. The only person able to give you launch authorization is me. You also hacked our systems, so you're about 2 steps past mutiny, Commander. You have 20 seconds to turn back.
Silence. 5 seconds. 10.
XO, Russell said quietly. Please have Commander Taylor destroy that starfighter when the deadline is up.
Lance is charged and ready to fire,
Taylor informed him, her voice subdued. Active sensors online. Target is locked in. Then, with less than a second to spare, Cavendish finally flipped her bird and began slowing down to return to the carrier.
Finally, Russell snapped. Taylor, keep her dialed in the whole way back. If she tries to pull a fast one, fire one warning shot.
Understood, Cag,
Taylor said quietly. Technically, Russell couldn't give her orders, but he was also the only one who could authorize shooting down one of their own birds.
Have the ship's marshal meet me in the flight deck, he ordered grimly.
Russell had forgotten that since Chameleon didn't have a military police detachment, it also didn't have the ship's marshal that would command that detachment. In the absence, however, Gunny Ramirez had stepped up to fill the role where needed, and he met the CAG on the flight deck with a fire team of 4 Marines. In powered battle armor.
A little excessive, Gunny?
Russell asked, eyeing the 5 hulking suits of metal and ceramic.
Lieutenant Riley warned me that the pilots are immune to stun gun beams,
Ramirez replied, the normally wiry man looming over the CAG's broad but short bulk.
But internal augments can't match armor muscles.
Fair enough, the CAG allowed, turning to watch as the automated system landed Cavendish's starfighter exactly on its point. For a moment, blasts of supercooled air covered the 9-meter-tall cylindrical craft. Then the exit ramp popped out. Flight Commander Cavendish stormed off the ship like an avenging supernova, charging down the ramp to stop directly in front of Russell. If she noticed Ramirez and his Marines, she gave no sign of it.
What the fuck do you think you're planning? She snapped. Glass will break you for this stunt, threatening me for following orders?
Glass has no authority to give you orders, Russell said mildly. Once you were seconded to my wing, you were under my command and through me, Captain Roberts's command. You are familiar with the chain of command, aren't you?
You just blew off a contact we'd had scheduled since we left Castle, she told him. And I don't know if the bastard will agree to meet with us again.
Any flight ops are to be cleared through me and the captain, he replied. If Glass had a contact, he should have been working with us instead of against us.
You didn't have need to know, Commander. Now, if we're done here, I need to see if I can reach out to our contact and fix your fuck-up.
No, Russell said flatly. You hacked into this ship's systems and shut down the safety overrides to carry out an unauthorized launch and then defied a return to base order. Gunny Ramirez, take Commander Cavendish into custody.
The Marines moved forward to grab the woman, their massive armored forms entirely out of scale with the small officer.
You can't be serious!
Deathly, Commander. Because last I checked, mutiny can still carry the death penalty even if we're not in combat. Take her to the brig, Gunnery Sergeant.
Chapter 15. New Edmonton System.
1610, May 26th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon. Kyle carefully settled the shuttle back down on Chameleon's deck as he received a feed from Chownik, updating him on the events while he was gone.
Oh, gods, he muttered, as he considered the fallout that was going to land on his plate as soon as Glass was updated.
What do you want us to do?
Chownik asked over the mental link.
Nothing, Kyle ordered. You made the right call. I'll deal with Glass.
Inhaling deeply, he rose and joined the spy and their bodyguards as they exited the shuttle. A maintenance crew was waiting to take over the spacecraft behind them, but otherwise the deck was empty.
Good to be back aboard,
Glass declared, patting the suit pocket he'd concealed Ostrovsky's data in.
Please let me know as soon as Commander Cavendish returns from her mission. Then we'll need to prepare to move on the Aurelia system.
I didn't authorize any mission by Cavendish, Kyle said carefully. Since she's under my command, shouldn't that have been run through me?
Technicalities, Captain,
the spy snapped.
I run this mission, and I needed Cavendish to take care of something you didn't have need to know for.
The spy stopped, turning to stare at Kyle.
What did your thugs do?
He demanded.
Flight Commander Cavendish is under arrest for mutiny, Kyle said flatly. My office, Glass, now.
Mutiny? She was operating under my authority,
Glass snarled, ignoring the Black Ops troopers and maintenance crew around them.
We can discuss this in my office, Mr. Glass, or you can join her in the brig,
Chameleon's captain told him.
Glass barely managed to contain himself until they reached Kyle's office near the bridge, clearly fuming the entire way. As soon as the door slid closed behind them, he exploded.
What kind of clusterfuck are you running, Captain?
He shouted.
This mission was always going to have components you couldn't be fully briefed on. Interfering in my orders is unacceptable. I demand that Cavendish be released and Rokos be relieved immediately.
No, Kyle said quietly, his back to the spy.
Mr. Glass, right now I am deciding whether or not you will be joining Commander Cavendish, not whether Commander Rokos was correct. What? She had orders and authorization. He was out of line.
Flight Commander Cavendish and her squadron were placed in Chameleon's fighter wing, Kyle pointed out. That meant they were under Rokos's command and, through him, mine. You, Mr. Glass, are not in that chain of command. You are, in fact, not in the chain of command of any military personnel aboard Chameleon. What you promised me was that I would have full command of Chameleon, a promise you have now repeatedly broken. You are a civilian. Officially, at least, though Glass's habit of failing to act like one was making Kyle suspicious.
You have no command authority here, and hence cannot protect Cavendish from the consequences of her obeying orders you had no authority to give. Do you understand me, Mr. Glass?
The office was very quiet for a long moment. The spy looked contemplative. His anger swept away in an instantaneous shift Kyle found mildly creepy.
I do, Glass said finally. My understanding, Captain Roberts, was that I remained in command of this mission.
You are in charge of this mission, Kyle pointed out. You are not in command. Even if you were, you would still need to run flight operations by any of your personnel, by me and by Commander Rokos. I understand, Glass, that you have been preparing this mission for a while. I have accepted a frankly intolerable lack of transparency so far out of that understanding, he continued. But flight operations without my approval? In opposition to standing orders? I command a warship, Mr. Glass. I cannot permit you to undermine the chain of command. Commander Cavendish's actions were unacceptable and illegal. Her career is over, and she could spend the next 3 decades in military prison for them. I can't levy the same punishment on you, and it was your bloody stupidity that put her in this position. So please, Mr. Glass,
Give me a good God's damn reason why I should keep trusting you.
The spy sighed.
I apologize, Captain, he said slowly. It is very easy in my line of work to default to lies, deception, and a lack of trust. Where possible, I prefer to rely on people I have worked with in the past. But I understand your point on chain of command. I made a mistake, he allowed. Commander Cavendish, based on that previous relationship, followed my orders. I am responsible, but...
He drew one of the data disks Ostrovsky had given him from his suit pocket.
May I, Captain?
He asked, gesturing to the wall screen.
Go ahead, Kyle said,
his implant authorizing the other man to link in. He was curious what the spy had that he thought could dig him out of this hole. The image of a tactical plot appeared on the screen. A single ship sat in the middle, most of its details included. A volcano-class heavy carrier, it was a 63 million cubic meter warship massing 20 million tons, one of the most powerful warships in the Terran Commonwealth Navy. A dusting of icons noted a defensive perimeter of the new Katana-type starfighters, though much less data was included on those. A wedge of new icons appeared. There were almost no details for these, though their speed and vector suggested starfighters. The defending fighters assumed a standard Commonwealth defensive perimeter, stretching out to intercept the inbound ships a million kilometers away from their mothership, far enough out that they would be unable to engage with fighter missiles or positron lances. Instead, the new starfighters flashed at just over 3 million kilometers, firing missiles from well outside normal starfighter missile range, and then turned their vectors 90 degrees away from the defenders. The entire exercise was running in accelerated time. Kyle could judge even without the system telling him that the attackers would evade interception. The defending starfighters went after the incoming missiles instead, but those disappeared in a wall of jamming far more capable than a starfighter missile should carry. 50 starfighters launched 100 missiles, and over half survived to reach the carrier. Despite the massive defenses the mothership carried, half a dozen of the weapons made it through and obliterated the carrier.
That was the centerpiece of the data Ostrovsky had on the Commonwealth's new fighter program,
Glass said quietly.
That wasn't a simulation. The missiles were practice warheads, but the flight time, the maneuvers, the ECM, all of that was done in real space.
I see, Kyle said slowly. I'm not sure how this relates to Cavendish, Glass asked.
It doesn't. It does relate to our mission. Target selection was always up to me. If the data on this starfighter and its weaponry is at Tau Ceti, however, I don't see a choice. Do you?
No, the captain admitted. We need this data.
This mission is more critical now than I thought, Glass replied. We still need to deliver a critical blow to the Commonwealth's infrastructure, but we also need to steal this research. We'll need to hit Aurelius to acquire Commonwealth munitions, he continued. We also need to meet up with the contact Cavendish was supposed to meet, as he was supposed to provide us with upgrade kits to bring our cataphracts up to their Delta standard. Some of that work is done already, but we don't have the Lance upgrades.
Kyle nodded slowly. Glass was giving him the briefing he should have provided when they left Castle.
We can still reach out to them? We should be able to, yes, the spy allowed. There's a giant wrench thrown in now, but I'll accept that's at least mostly my fault. He sighed. That contact won't deal with anyone he hasn't met, which meant it had to be me or Cavendish. If you're going to blame someone for not telling you what was going on, blame me, Glass said. And let Laura out of the damned brig.
The spy seemed to have made a major effort to actually bring Kyle into the loop, so he nodded slowly.
She's still grounded, he said firmly. That's Rokos's call, and he needs to trust whoever he's taking into battle. After everything she's pulled, orders or not, he can't. I wouldn't in his place.
Fine,
Glass agreed. I'll reach out to my contact as well.
I'll let you know what the next step for getting those upgrade kits is.
Chapter 16. New Edmonton System. 2300, May 26th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian, date, time. Chameleon. Kyle was eyeing the scanners as the sublight Clipper freighter detached the tube they'd delivered food and other supplies to Chameleon from, and drifted away under careful gas thrusters. If the interstellar equivalent of a bumboat saw anything unusual in the quantity of foodstuff the Q-ship had bought, her crew was wise enough not to say anything. They might later, but that was fine. Part of the point of this operation was for the attack to be traced back here, after all. Technically, Commander Taylor had the watch, but this was the first watch the young woman had ever held in a potentially hostile environment. So Kyle had brought a data pad out into the bridge with him and was pointedly doing paperwork, recording the physical, league-minted coinage he'd just handed over for another month's worth of food, as a matter of fact. All that was really important was that the captain, despite being on the bridge, did not have the watch. Fleet Commander Jenny Taylor did, and the blonde officer was doing a fine job. And if she needed backup, her captain was right there. When Glass came rushing onto the bridge, Kyle was glad he'd made that choice. The old spy disconcerted him. He wasn't leaving his junior officers to deal with the man.
Ah, Captain, good, Glass said when he spotted him. Can we speak in private?
My office is right here, Kyle agreed genially. He glanced over at Taylor and gave her a quick thumbs up. If she needed him, she could still buzz him, after all. She somewhat hesitantly returned the gesture, but she'd been doing fine so far, which gave Kyle a level of confidence as he led Glass into his office. What is it? He asked, taking a seat behind his desk and gesturing the spy to sit.
I finally made contact with Trickster, Glass said calmly. They've agreed to meet us, but only on their terms.
I thought that was basically how things were going to work with your contact, Kyle observed.
They're being very specific, and I don't like it, the spy replied. Before, we were meeting someone in the Nexon Cloud to negotiate a delivery that would have come by one of the Clippers in the business of servicing starships. Now, they want me to physically meet them on his station, and I quote, bring the big captain, no one else, Glass concluded. Trickster had people watching us. I don't trust Trickster, and I don't want to take Chameleon all the way to their station.
Where's their station? Kyle asked.
Here in New Edmonton, the spy replied. The system has an outer ice belt, much like Sol's Kuiper belt. The station is hidden out there, far away from prying eyes. Trickster is one of the more notorious League pirates, and for reasons I haven't managed to discover, Dictator Periklos wants them dead.
They personally pissed off the man who took over the League? I'm almost impressed.
Don't be. Trickster is murderous scum, but they've got the tech we need.
Glass shook his head.
The Cataphract D has better acceleration, better ECM, a more powerful positron lance. You know better than I whether we need those upgrade kits, Captain.
I'm guessing that Ostrovsky's intel says we're running up against katanas at least in Tau Ceti, if not in Aurelius, Kyle asked.
Probably not, Aurelius, but one of the production lines is in Tau Ceti,
Glass admitted. If we send out people up against katanas in the half-upgraded cataphracts we have now, when we have a better option, we're killing them ourselves, Chameleon's captain said grimly. Tell Trickster we'll make their meeting, then forward the coordinates to Lau's people. And I'll make sure our teeth are sharp when we walk into the spider's den.
0700, May 27th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian, date, time. New Edmonton Ice Belt. Even more than inner system asteroid belts, ice belts were far less dense than media liked to portray them. As Chameleon approached the coordinates they'd been given,
There were no swarms of ice asteroids attempting to chew them up. There was a level of ice dust that was actively dangerous to the ship at any significant velocity, but that was why even civilian ships had electromagnetic deflectors and armor. Kyle carefully checked the readouts he was receiving to be sure that their current speed, several thousand kilometers a second, was sustainable without increasing the deflectors to less civilian levels. "Where exactly is this station?" he wondered aloud. 8 hours of flight had carried them over 22 light minutes farther out from McMurray, far into the uninhabited outskirts of the system. They were rapidly approaching the coordinates Glass had been given, but there was nothing in the 10 light seconds around them except for half a dozen chunks of ice of various sizes.
"Should be exactly at the coordinates," Glass told him. "Unless Trickster is being a complete bastard anyway."
"Taylor?" Kyle asked. "What are you reading?"
"One of our local ice chunks is right at those coordinates," she reported. "Might be denser than the rest, too. Hard to tell on passives. Want me to ping them?"
"No," he said slowly. "Lau, take us in as if we're expecting a docking port on that chunk of rock. Taylor, keep the hatches closed, but spin up the lances and charge the missiles."
"Yes, sir," she replied.
Lau kept their attention silently on guiding the big Q-ship in toward the presumed station.
"Two of the other chunks of ice share an orbit with our target," the tactical officer reported as they decelerated toward their destination. "Both are about 100,000 clicks away, not on top of them, but..."
"Close enough to mount defensive weapons or starfighters," Kyle finished for her. "Keep an eye on them. For that matter, keep a lance targeted on them." Her grin in reply was predatory.
"2 light seconds from target, on course for 00, Lau reported shortly.
"Mr. Glass, if you'd like to reach out to our friend and see how they feel about guests?" The spy nodded and closed his eyes, focusing on his implants. Kyle's access to the systems showed him logging into the communications systems and sending a directional radio message forward.
"Response incoming from the target coordinates," Taylor announced.
There was a tight beam radio signal, one focused directly on Chameleon and flagged for Glass. While Kyle could view it, he left it to the spy. Their working relationship required some trust to go both ways, after all. Finally, Glass opened his eyes.
"We should be seeing a beacon on Judeca Station shortly," he told them. "That should guide us to a docking port for cargo transfer. Captain Roberts and I are to board the station and meet with Trickster directly. We'll make payment then, and they'll begin transfer immediately."
"If they've got decent cargo handling equipment, we should be able to load the upgrade kits in an hour or less," Kyle noted. "Seems like your friend is playing straight so far."
"Would you object, my dear Captain, if I asked you to keep Commander Rokos's people in their fighters a while longer, regardless?"
"I wasn't planning on doing anything else." Chapter 17. New Edmonton System. 0735, May 27th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Judeca Station, Ice Belt. The cargo transfer tunnel was almost 20 meters across, clearly designed to not only allow movement of any size cargo pod anyone cared to be using, but also complete starfighters. Most fascinating of all, it was carved out of the ice of the asteroid Trickster had buried his space station in. There were supporting beams running through the ice, but those were the only sign of human interference. Kyle suspected that those beams were also heating elements and tracks for cutting lasers. Most likely, any access to Judeca Station was temporary, filled with new ice once it was no longer needed. Keeping the station completely encased in ice would protect it from almost any detection. He and Glass followed a guideline down the bottom of the tunnel toward a tiny-seeming human-sized airlock on the metal hull at the far end. Impressively, the spy was almost as comfortable in zero gravity as Kyle was. They glided to a careful stop at the personnel airlock, orienting themselves with the safety arrows as the door opened, and then made the inevitably graceless transition into Judeca Station's artificial gravity.
The airlock filled with air, and the clear plastic bubbles that had extended from their ship suits retracted as the clothing's sensors confirmed a breathable atmosphere. Safe, the inner door slid open to reveal the form of an absolutely immense human being. It looked like he'd been easily 2 meters tall, taller even than Kyle, and then someone had gone to town with cybernetics. Both of the man's legs had been replaced with immense monstrosities of steel and artificial muscles, and armor plating had been attached across his bare chest and upper arms. He grunted at them and gestured for them to follow him as he turned back into the station. Unlike the processing stations in McMurray orbit, Giudecca Station's corridors did not look like they could have been in any other station in the galaxy. Only the floor and inner wall here were metal. The roof and outer wall were uncovered ice. The lights were dim. Only the extra processing included in Kyle's neural implant allowing him to pick up enough light to see clearly. Glass, he suspected, had something closer to the Black Ops implants and could probably see in the dark. Their silent guide led them deeper into the station, into corridors that looked like they should have been full of people. The more populated the areas looked like they should be, the dirtier they became. The pristine ice walls of the entrance gave way to steel smeared with rust and dirt. But Kyle noted that all of the mechanical equipment was perfectly maintained. Air intakes, lights, the security systems, everything that was related to safety or the functioning of the station was in perfect working order, if occasionally smeared with dirt to make sure it didn't stand out. "We're getting a show," he sent Glass silently through their implants. "Why would Trickster want us to think this place is run down?"
"Because they're completely averse to anyone knowing anything about them," the spy replied. "I'm surprised they want to meet us in person. They don't meet anyone in person."
That was not encouraging. Finally, their guide led them to a large security door and turned back to face them.
"Weapons," he grunted.
Kyle shrugged and surrendered his pistol. He doubted that the gun would make that much of a difference. If they were making it out of here, it was on Glass.
"Enter,"
the giant ordered. Russell sat in the command seat of his starfighter and watched the sensor reports being fed to him by Chameleon as if his stony gaze would somehow conjure answers. Giudecca Station was a well-concealed facility, and they could pick out only a handful of details, even while docked to her. Her two trailing sisters were surrendering even fewer secrets, and the CAG itched to order an active sweep of them. He doubted Chownik, the man who had that authority right now, felt any differently. But unless their new friends decided to open the ball, Chameleon's crew didn't want to dance.
"Are you seeing any starfighters?"
he asked his gunner quietly. That worthy, in addition to running the cataphract's missile armament and ECM, was also charged with reviewing sensor data in the command starfighter.
"Nothing, which I don't trust for a second,"
Flight Lieutenant Raul Alvarado, a gaunt man with wispy hair and pale skin, replied.
"Giudecca is armed, and those other two ice balls have at least missile launchers, or I'll eat my uniform."
"Agreed," he muttered.
He brought up the map of the area and overlaid the launch vectors for his squadrons. Alpha was in the launchers right now, with himself and an extra from Echo's Black Ops starfighters. Now that they were in place and his shoulder blades were itching, he wished he'd thought to drop those stealthier birds into space somewhere along the way. He wasn't used to having starfighters that had a half-decent chance of going unnoticed.
"Listen," he said over the implant network, pulling in his squadron leaders. "While I don't see any reason why our new friends might betray us, I don't trust them as far as we can throw them. So if they decide to open the party, this is what we'll do."
Edvard watched carefully through the pickups on Chameleon's hull as the cargo hatch on the other end of the tunnel slowly slid open. A handful of men and women in closed ship suits came out, guiding and directing the mostly automated jet-equipped harnesses that moved the 10-meter cubes of standard cargo pods. All were visibly armed, but it was sidearms and slung submachine guns, nothing that would be a threat to people in powered battle armor, and yet he knew that Glass and the captain were both uncomfortable about this meeting,
and those cargo pods could hide an entire platoon in full battle armor apiece.
Riley, he pinged the Black Ops platoon commander. Have your platoon go out and be friendly security, he ordered. I'm going to have everyone else strap on battle armor, just in case these guys decide not to be friendly.
Wilco, she replied. Can I throw one of my squads in armor? Might help make the point while keeping our numbers down to what they're expecting for a pirate ship. He hesitated for a moment, but...
Agreed, he said. Keep your eyes open. This whole thing is making me twitchy.
Can't we just jump clear if there's a problem? She asked. I thought we'd be far enough out for that.
Edvard chuckled. I have no idea, he admitted. Let me check.
Flipping channels, he raised the bridge.
Commander Chownik, how's it looking outside?
Quiet enough to make me wonder if this might actually go off without a hitch, the XO admitted. Though I swear there's a bullseye painted on my back. Does their cargo look right to you, Elmage?
Specs the CAG gave me say 10 cargo pods should have it all, and that's what I'm seeing, Edvard replied. I hear you on the bullseye, though.
Are we far enough out to go FTL if there's a problem?
Sure, if you want to leave Roberts and Glass behind,
Chownik said with a chuckle of laughter.
I may be half machine, but I don't think even I can be that cold. If things go to hell, what are your odds on extraction?
Edvard pursed his lips in thought.
I'm going to have two platoons in battle armor in about a minute, he pointed out. Add in my HQ section, and I've got 140 suits ready to go punch a hole. I don't like to underestimate anybody, but that station is only big enough for about 2,000 people. I don't care if every damn one of them has power armor. They don't stand a chance against a company of Castle's damned Marines, sir.
Despite the intentionally dilapidated state of the rest of Judeca Station, Trickster's office was neat and clean. It could have belonged to any middle manager in human space. A plain wooden desk and a wall turned over to a wall screen. It didn't look particularly different from Kyle's own office aboard Chameleon. The occupant of the desk was an enigma. Trickster wore a hood and a mask painted in a checkerboard of white and black squares. Coupled with a surprisingly androgynous figure, a black suit with a long-sleeved white shirt and white gloves, there was no way to tell if Trickster was a man or woman.
Come in, come in,
they instructed Kyle and Glass, their voice shifting modulations as they spoke, the mask clearly including some kind of electronic filter.
Mr. Glass, Captain Roberts, it is my pleasure.
We're here for our upgrade kits, Trickster, Glass said, his voice impressively level given the strange harlequin behind the desk.
I know, the pirate replied. I hope Jose was not too intimidating. The assholes who upgraded him did his neural pathways no favors.
Jose, presumably, was the mountain of a man who'd guided them there. Apparently, his cybernetics hadn't been entirely voluntary. Glass sighed.
You clearly want more than your money. What is it?
Oh, I want my money,
Trickster replied, the modulator not hiding the smile in their voice.
I also wanted to actually meet you face to face, Mr. Glass. I have attempted to put together the components of your operation, and yet I find myself coming up short. Not many are that skilled, though the presence of a Commonwealth Q-ship does suggest so many possibilities.
And how much will it cost us to keep those possibilities to yourself? The spy asked.
Discretion is an assumed part of my business dealings, Glass, the pirate said flatly. I would not have survived this long were it not. I merely wanted to meet you and Captain Roberts here. He, a legend forged by publicity and media, and you, who would be a legend were the records not sealed. The contrast is delightful.
Trickster made a pass-it-over gesture.
Nonetheless, I would like my money.
Glass slid a data stick onto the table.
Codes and numbers for anonymous accounts with the Bank of Goldis Swaziland, he said simply. The agreed amount. Goldis Swaziland was an independent system the Commonwealth had so far left alone, most likely because even Terra could use a black market banking system that asked no questions and took no names.
Good, Trickster replied. My bank account is satisfied. My curiosity is satisfied. Yours is not, but that is the nature of the game. Your cargo is being loaded, Captain Roberts. I could, perhaps, see my way to providing additional hardware, but I suspect your plan depends on using hardware that can be more easily traced than my goods. Jose will escort you back to your ship. While you are on Judeca Station, you are under my protection. I will not wish you luck. We share an enemy, but not a cause.
Thank you, Glass said with a small bow. The two Federation men rose. As they turned to leave, the door slid open behind them to reveal Jose's immense form. The giant grunted, gestured for them to follow him, and then stopped mid-motion. He spasmed once, his face contorting in pain. Despite whatever had just happened, he began to spin around, moving at a pace that Kyle couldn't follow. Then his chest exploded, spraying gore and metal everywhere as the armor-piercing grenade that had been fired into the massive cyborg's chest detonated. Chapter 18. New Edmonton System. 0810, May 27th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon, Ice Belt. Edvard had stepped out to join Riley's platoon in running security in the cargo bay itself by the time the first pod reached Chameleon's cargo bay. The leader of the armed men escorting the pod gave him what probably passed for a salute among the League's condottieri.
I'm Henry. These are my boys and gals, he said brightly. We're just longshoremen today, but my folk feel naked without the guns.
Then you won't mind if we watch you like hawks, Edvard replied.
Edvard, I run security here.
Henry snorted.
And if you ain't somebody's Marine, my mama's a virgin. But it ain't my business. I leave that kind of game to the boss. Move them on up, boys and gals, he grinned. Where do you want them?
The harnesses included built-in small-scale mass manipulators that reduced the mass of the multi-hundred-ton cargo pods to something that could roll on the small wheels included. Edvard gestured for one of the chiefs charged with handling the cargo bay to take over traffic direction and stepped aside. Henry moved